Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Show through BBS Radio. It is Saturday, September 3rd, 2011. I'm coming to you from Ottawa, Canada area. I apologize to listeners for missing last week's show, which I missed completely, and fortunately, that's the first show we've missed in 5 years of the Zero Point Show. So it's nice to be back on air today, and I'll bring my co-host on from Toronto area, Jim Moffat. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
Okay, how are you?
Okay, I didn't think you handled any of last week's show.
I didn't because I wasn't really sort of prepared to.
No, you would have had no preparation. That's what I figured.
Yeah, and to be perfectly honest, it was kind of, I was in the middle of writing something, so I thought, you know, I could sit here and struggle with this for 2 hours, or we could just archive it. Don said they'd play an archive show, and I thought, you know, it's probably just better because it wouldn't have been a very good program, and
Yeah. Yeah, so great. So we're back on there today. And that's quite something, eh, Jim? We've had 5 years of shows now.
Yeah, it's pretty consistent, eh?
I think I missed one other show or two where you handled it.
Well, I did. I know I did one when you were in New Zealand, I believe.
Yeah.
And maybe one other when you had a family function or something. But it's well over 5 years, eh? Because I've been living where I'm living here for 5 years, and I think it began that spring before. I think you had done a few shows before I came on, and I think I started in April of 2006, I think that's when I first did the show with you. But you'd already done a couple before that, so.
Yeah,
it's quite a long time. Thanks to BBS for providing us with the forum. It's been really an interesting experience, and
It's encouraging to think there's all that archived material up there. I mean, we've covered a wealth of topics, and
yeah,
we come back to many of the same things from different angles. But it takes time to develop an understanding of the framework of ideas that we're presenting. It's certainly not something that anyone's going to understand quickly or easily. It takes effort over time.
I don't know if you saw the email that I sent you last night, but I'm kind of struggling with that a little bit on a different level because I've gotten to a place in the book that I'm writing, The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, in which I present the overview of Christopher's work, and I'm also trying to put it in a context of the science versus religion debate and existing ideas on the nature of consciousness in modern science and psychology, and there are different aspects to the book. It's not all specifically just a presentation of Christopher's ideas, but that's the basis of the book, I got to a place, Chris, where I had done three chapters providing a basic overview of the history of the kind of development of the model of consciousness that you've created. And the earlier parts had to do with the Gurdjieff-Yuspensky fourth wave material, certain basic ideas that were drawn from that material. And then in the third chapter, I really get into an exposition of the heart doctrine and the zero point hypothesis. And you know, I put it that in, it's also, there's other contextual material to sort of develop that idea, material on the holographic paradigm in both psychology and physics and other things. And then I sort of went away for a couple of chapters because I wanted to talk a little bit about Gurdjieff as a master and the idea of a master and how that's not recognized within Western thought. And then I had material about the how modern psychology studied consciousness and the reasons why it didn't, how it's really not at all scientific, and it's led to the creation of what you term the head doctrine. And then the next chapter that I was going to deal with, it's going to be the last chapter in this volume. It's a multi-volume work because it's just too complicated to put it all into one volume. So the next chapter that I'm going to write is, I'm trying to figure out what exactly should I say about your work in order to give an idea of its complexity, but it also at the same time to restrict it to certain key ideas. And I, that's what I was asking you about in the email, is like, what do you think I should address? Like, as I say, I gave the basic ideas of the heart doctrine, and I gave the basic idea of what the zero point is and how this is something that you are positing exists on both a psychological and a cosmological level, that any quantum, any being, any planet, anything, is that all of this originates in higher dimensional.
Yeah, it's like any living entity.
Yes,
has a zero point center. Any living entity.
And everything in this world is rooted into these higher dimensions. I think that's the key idea. So you have this picture of human beings as being these multidimensional beings who are rooted into these higher dimensions, and that's where the life and consciousness principles originate. And we exist in a multidimensional universe. I was trying to get to that. So I've been struggling with that. I realized, like, when I started the book, originally my idea was like, well, I'll give like this, you know, overview of your work, and I'll talk about various issues. But then as I started to write it, I realized, wow, that's so complex, and you have to know so many different things to really begin to appreciate. And that's what I'm trying to do. Is I'm not trying to. If people want to know about your ideas, they can read your books. They can read The Heart Doctrine, you know, the God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. That these are, you know, extremely detailed, complex books. But I realize that it's, as we've said so many times on the program, if we keep repeating things, it's only because you can't grasp the enormity of how different this is from the framework of modern psychology and modern science and the basic understanding of things, the basic assumptive framework. Like, everything in this model essentially challenges the assumptive framework in which most of modern science and psychology is based. And yet at the same time, it, even though it leads to a radical reconsideration of things, much of what's in science and psychology can be subsumed, I think, by this framework, because I think it's more comprehensive and it's more coherent.
Yeah, at least it provides a potential model that could help us account for out-of-body experiences, after-death states, all these psychical phenomena that have been dismissed within the mainstream. I mean, it does provide an alternate model of the structure of reality, essentially.
It deals with the very basic enigmas about what is the nature of life and what is the nature of consciousness? Like, where does life come from? I mean, on the one hand, we can say, well, we know that life comes from these material processes and the human being, and we know all sorts of things in biology that account for this. But in a way, and in chemistry, but we don't really know how that transition occurs from somehow matter, which is inert and lifeless, suddenly combines to create life. And I mean, this is like a huge gap. And of course, the nature of consciousness itself. How does consciousness arise from supposedly unconscious material
process?
There's a huge explanatory gap there that you can't really say has been addressed by modern science and modern psychology. And this, by placing human beings in this multidimensional cosmos, which is animate, which is intelligent, it changes everything. It's like we're arguing that life comes from life and consciousness comes from consciousness, but on different levels. So it's an extraordinarily different framework to pursue these questions.
Yeah, it's like life comes from within, without, out of higher dimensions. I did actually get your email, and I printed out the overview you'd given on your book, and I had read that through, and I was working away at your chapter. You had a beautiful expression on the first page of it, explaining zero points as a portal. I forget that line. Do you have it handy there, your paper?
Yeah, I could in a second.
You had an excellent expression that I really liked on the first page of. I started reading your article, but haven't had enough time to really go through it and get back to you with feedback.
I didn't even know if you'd see it yet. So
yeah, I had. I had last evening,
okay,
but
great,
I wanted to print it out too, give it a bit more time.
Because my thought was I was sitting here yesterday. I was going through the heart doctrine, and I'd done this before. And I was trying to think, you know, I want to sketch out the rest of the book, and I want to start providing an outline. So I was just reading through it, and I realized at one point, well, maybe I should ask you, but given that it's your work, you know, and that you know it better than I do, that so maybe I should ask you what you think I should include, you know, because I really there are a few topics. I think the idea of the Zimzum contraction, which you might actually speak about in a minute, is an interesting idea, because I think that's something that, from my understanding of it, that's something that occurs on both a psychological and a cosmological level, which I find very interesting, and the idea of the vacated heart space. I think is this what you're talking about? Zero-point hypothesis. The latter refers to Dr. Holmes's claims that zero points, a concept articulated in Madame Blavatsky's occult classic, The Secret Doctrine, are the portals that connect all bodies and beings in the phenomenal world with the higher dimensions from which they originate and by which they are informed.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's a really nicely expressed.
Because it's funny, because I'm still not even sure I really understand. I think one of the ideas is that I hadn't included in this chapter, which I was saving for the next chapter, was that explanation of how, like, the zero points aren't in space, but, like, that what we regard as space, but space is sort of squeezed out of these zero points, which is an interesting way of looking at it. Like, I mean, it's kind of counterintuitive, because I think the idea is that we think, like, these are points in space, but it's like it's actually the reverse. It's like
it's an alternate model of the nature of space, consistent with like holographic theory, and how each of our space-time lives grows out from a point. So it is an alternate model of space, higher dimensional space underlying familiar four-dimensional space. So it is really complex, and zero points are like the portals rooted into higher dimensions and then manifesting outwardly in our familiar space-time.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because Blavatsky what I know of her work is that she's quite insistent that modern science's conception of space is wrong, and that she provides a very radically different view on it. That
she says space as we think it exists doesn't exist. And she calls, like, what she calls the eternal parent space, she calls it the real space.
Okay.
So space and location in our familiar term, she says, is an illusion. I'm pleased to announce, Jim, I've published another of my books, is now available through Amazon, and it's called Zero Point Teachings, Selected Writings of Mystical Psychologist and Scientist Christopher P. Holmes. I published that almost 2 weeks ago. I haven't sold a copy yet, but I put the ads up on my site. And
Is this the material from that you published in the Esoteric Quarterly? Is that?
Yeah, actually, I was working at a book after Karen's death, the book was to be called Zero Point Teachings, but it got so big that I divided it into two sections, and I'm going to put my political writings in the second book. But this first book all focuses on this concept of every man and woman is a star, which is Aleister Crowley, his first principle of magic. And the concept there is that every individual has a divine source emanation at the core of their being. And that's one of Crowley's teachings that's also within other esoteric literature. So the book is a selection of a series of articles that I've published on my website over the last 5 to 10 years. And then at the end of the book, it has the four sections of the article series that I had accepted for the Journal of Esoteric Studies. They have their website at www.esotericstudies.net. And I've been very pleased that my fourth article in that series was accepted for publication, Jim, and I did all the revisions required of it. I'm so pleased to have had that article series published, because it's like never in my life have I really had professional scholarly type feedback on my work.
Yeah.
And every one of the four articles of that series went through their
committee
to their reviewers, and their reviewers had so many valuable comments and suggestions, which really helped me refine each of the sections.
Yeah.
And I'm so pleased with the article series.
I just started reading. I had read the first three, and I started rereading them yesterday again to help me. And I printed them out because somehow I misplaced the copies with my notes, but they read more like academic articles, and they're good. And it's like, again, it's a huge challenge to try to condense these incredibly complex ideas into something manageable and something readable. It's like it's very different that way. But as an overview of your work, I think that the Esoteric Quarterly, the Journal of Esoteric Studies, those articles are a very good introduction, I think, and a good overview of the position that you're developing. So,
I
get those out there.
I love the title of the last article, which is An Alternate Model of the Higher Dimensional Structure of Human Existence. Like, wow! But it's true, because that's really what it is. It's an alternate model, and it's not simply like Christopher Holmes's model.
Yeah.
Instead, it's grounded in esoteric studies, and you know, I draw from everything from Kabbalistic teachings to yogic Vedic teachings and Blavatsky and a wide range of sources, but kind of bring it together and give it a new interpretation in the light of modern physics and the holographic model that's emerging in physics. I mean, it's really quite profound, I'm very pleased with this new book. It was Zelchka in Croatia who did the layouts on it.
Yeah.
And she always does everything so differently and creatively, eh? Wait till you see this book. It's really quite spectacularly done, as I felt the Gurdjieff books were by her. You know,
yeah.
I love the way she uses the black pages, which generally I hadn't seen hardly ever in other literature.
Yeah, very, very impressive. I'll have to get a copy of that.
I've ordered some copies, so I just ordered 30 copies in, so they'll be arriving this week. Did you ever get a copy of The Slug, Slug?
No, and that's what I just realized. I never got a copy of The Slug.
So maybe I should send you a package with both of them.
I'd like to get around to reading that. I'm actually on a bit of a... because I wrote this material on Gurdjieff, I kind of want a bit of a reading of various material on Gurdjieff. There's a book by Paul Beckham Taylor that came out a couple of years ago called Gurdjieff, A New Life, which was a biography, which I read. And it's interesting. He sort of challenges the accuracy of some of the things in both James Webb's and James Moore's biographies, which are the two major biographies in English. I think he's, if I get this correctly, I think he's Gurdjieff's son. Like, Gurdjieff had a lot of children, a lot of different pupils, eh? So I think Gurdjieff was his father, if I'm getting this correctly.
It's funny, I had contact, someone wrote me who was supposed to be the literary agent for Gurdjieff's grandson.
Oh.
And directed me to a website where some of his material was up on, all about the Enneagram.
Oh.
And I went to the website, and I was so unimpressed.
Oh, really?
It didn't seem to deal at all with explaining, like, the fundamental cosmic laws. You know how some people take the Enneagram, and they kind of give different attributes at every point, and it seems completely kind of arbitrary?
Yeah.
I mean, it might not be, but it's not elaborated. I think a lot from first principles. Like, I want to understand the logic of things, not just kind of arbitrary.
Sorry? I think there's been a real William Patrick Patterson addresses that in Taking with the Left Hand, where basically that was done by Claudio Naranjo and Helen Palmer and others who have basically bastardized the Gurdjieff teaching and have created
on the Enneagram.
Very arbitrary. Because I was actually in a thing at work several years ago where they were using the Enneagram and just assigning this arbitrary attributes, which I thought was completely ridiculous. You know, I just thought, you have no idea how this is not what this is about. But
especially when you have to elaborate the basic principles of the laws of three and seven.
That would be a start. Very peculiar. What I was going to say, just to finish, was that so I've been reading some different material, and there's an expanded version of Our Life with Mr. Gurdjieff by Thomas and Olga de Hartmann, which I've been reading, which is very, very interesting. I read that book, 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, the little book, but it's very, very good. It's very interesting, and things that I'd kind of forgotten and things I didn't know, but I had communication with Donna Brown at the Esoteric Quarterly, and I think I'm going to, as soon as I finish this book, I'm going to revise my book, An Alien Intelligence. I'm just going to expand it a little bit, not drastically, but there's new material that I want to add. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to take material out of that and submit it to a two-part paper to the Esoteric Quarterly,
good.
She expressed an interest, and they don't. I don't think they've ever actually published, other than your work. I don't think they've ever published anything about Gurdjieff at all.
And my work hasn't focused on Gurdjieff. I was thinking of doing another article for them on Gurdjieff's view of the causes of war.
Oh wow!
Based on my new edition of The Slugs.
Yeah.
I'm anxious for you to see that, because there are things I found in this last reread of Beelzebub's Tales I'd just never seen before there.
We talked about that. As you change, you see things, that you didn't realize were in there. I mean, there's so much in there, but your perspective changes on, too, because...
I did want to say today is September 3rd, and I would like today, I wanted to kind of spend a little bit of time talking about 9/11 and events around that and some things that are happening in the truth movement. I kind of focus on that a bit today, and then I was saying to Don at the station that maybe the second hour we'd open up the lines for anyone to call in. I don't know, have you ever read the article I wrote called Fabled Airplanes, The Role of the Corporate Media in Creating and Maintaining the Mass Hypnosis of the American Public? Have you ever read that article I wrote? Because I want to talk a little bit about that, because I've had, because of it being the week of 9/11, a lot of the Truth Patriot radio shows are focusing on 9/11 research, and I've had a few invitations to, and have some upcoming radio shows this week. If anyone goes to my website at zeropoint.ca, if you go to the event calendar, I'll list the shows up there. I have one coming up on Tuesday, 8 to 10 in the morning, on Oracle Broadcasting with Charles Giuliani on Truth Hurts Radio. And it's a two-hour radio interview on my piece, Fabled Airplanes. and then I'll likely be on Rick Adams next week. He's invited me, although the day's not set yet. And then I did another interview the other day with Don Nikoloff on another station. And so there's been interest coming up in some of my work on fabled airplanes. So I don't want to spend the whole day today, but I would like to give a little bit of a sample of that and talk a little bit about my awakening and kind of what happened to me when, you know, I learned of the issues around 9/11, and so I thought maybe today we'd try to focus on that, and then we'll come back. For listeners who are familiar with our show, for the most part, Jim and I focus on mystical, occult, esoteric studies and science and such. But at times, I'm also very political and very concerned with what's happening in our countries. So anyway, today, in kind of honor of 9/11, I thought we'd focus on that. Were you aware, Jim, that there's a major international conference on in Toronto this week?
Yes.
At Ryerson,
At Ryerson. It's basically a who's who of... I just learned about this. It's a who's who of the most important people in the... I would say, like, it seems to be all the major figures. I noticed that Peter Dale Scott is appearing, which is interesting. I've never heard him speak, and David Ray Griffin, Richard Gage, the architect that you and I heard speak in Toronto, Zwicker, the media guy from Toronto. Wrote that great book on the media.
And Michelle Chasidovsky.
Barry Zwicker, sorry. Yeah, and I don't know who that is. Who's that?
Michelle Chasidovsky.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a university professor at the University of Ottawa.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah, okay.
He has this, I get their mailings, daily mailings from globalresearch.ca.
Okay.
And very, very profound writer. And I mean, it's not just his writing, but the articles they send out. Boy, it's just an excellent news source, is globalresearch.ca. So he's there, and Mike Gravel.
Oh, yeah, Mike, yeah.
Yeah, Cynthia McKinney. It's an excellent cast of characters. I called up today because I thought of going down to it, eh?
Oh, yeah.
I'm coming down for it. But like, I went to the website today, and I found out they've sold out.
Oh, really?
They only had 200 seats, but I'm glad to hear they sold those out.
I was hoping to kind of, I thought maybe I could just go down, and I didn't realize that it was that restricted. That's too bad.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that either, because I didn't think I could do the full 4 days, but I was going to go down for some of it.
I know one of the organizers, David McIntosh, so I'll have to get in touch with him and, you know, get him to give me some updates as to what... I hope it gets some media coverage. It'll be interesting to see how it's, you know, if it's covered at all. It should be, you would think, because it's...
Yeah, actually, I've already seen a short item on it on CTV.
Yeah, and...
announcing the conference, so they're trying to...
Ryerson has a journalism school, so you'd think that they'd be able to get, some word out. So,
yeah. It's amazing how 9/11 won't die. Eh? It doesn't go away.
But it does in a way. Like, I mean, I totally agree with you. Yeah, it doesn't go away, but it's very much to me like that. You know, I've sort of been through this movie before, like with the Kennedy assassination. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
like it goes along sort of in this parallel reality where people know that, you know, that the official story is complete horseshit. Pardon my French, but that's what it is. And yet, everybody acts as if like the emperor has no clothes. You know, it's the same old story. It's like, you know, people are still being, Americans and Canadians are fighting in Afghanistan, and Americans are in Iraq, and it's like all this awful stuff still goes on.
Yeah.
Why? supposedly because of 9/11. I mean, it's legitimized all these further crimes, and so many people. There's so much opposition to the official story, and so many compelling critiques, and yet, you know, it just doesn't seem to have any impact in the mainstream media. Like it's going, it's happening. I mean, there's certainly, you know, certainly it certainly has an influence amongst people, but it doesn't seem to translate into anything really meaningful. Like, you know, why aren't any of these people on trial?
Yeah, why aren't they in jail? I know. I mean, the way I see it is because they have complete control of the policing community and the CIA and the FBI and the RCMP and the Mossad, and it's like those same people who perpetrated 9/11 control our government. That's how I see it.
Yeah,
it's this whole global crime syndicate that's kind of usurped our democracies.
The Cheney's out there selling books, you know. Like, I mean, that's he's written his book, eh? So he's out there.
Yeah, I heard that.
You know, I mean, he's like already the most evil, shameless liar of all time. Like,
I know.
He's like the Prince of Freaking Darkness, you know, and he's out there, and now he's going to tell everybody that, you know, everything that they did has prevented further attacks. I'm like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I beg to differ. Like, that's the other side of it, is that this idiot's going to be on all the mainstream media, you know, lying through his teeth, and people are going to be according him all sorts of respect and everything, and I'm thinking, my God, you know.
The mainstream media do so much around 9/11 to try to shore up the official story.
Oh, yeah.
That's how I see it. I mean, Obama's going out and giving a talk somewhere, and did you hear the 9/11 responders were not allowed to attend Obama's presentation?
No.
Had you heard that? Yeah, I heard that somewhere on the Truth Network. Yeah, 9/11 responders weren't. I guess a lot of 9/11 responders are kind of waking up, and you know they're dying of cancers and things like this. But anyway. It's shocking. I want to go back a little bit in my life. Like, when 9/11 occurred, I was working at Rideau Correctional Center as a psychologist, and that's a provincial correctional institute in Canada, in Ontario. And I heard of the first airplane attack in the morning, and I went over to my range, which is what, like, I had a range with 24 guys who were taking my program, and I watched the events unfold with them. And it was interesting, and I remember on that occasion seeing the second airplane hit the second tower and kind of watch the events, and then the collapse of the towers, which is just horrendous. It's like, it kind of leaves you in shock and awe, like, overwhelming. And it's interesting to me that, like, at the time, I was pretty naive politically, socially, politically, and I don't fault myself for that. You know, I'm kind of a family man. I've had 5 children, so I was busy as a householder, and I worked in corrections as a psychologist, and my spare time went into esoteric studies. So I've been pretty naive through my life, I would say, as to what's gone on politically. And I had no question of the events on that day. Like, I couldn't have imagined what I now believe. Like, I had just no doubt. I just accepted whole hog kind of what, you know, you're led to believe by the media. And it really wasn't until 5 years later. Well, 5 years later, I was invited down to New York City to be in a movie called The Metaphysia, which actually came out this year, and I'm in it for a brief spot, like 10 to 15 seconds, nothing very significant. But when we went down, Karen and I drove down to New York in my van, and it was really eerie at the border going over into the States. We were kind of called inside, and they kind of wanted to know everywhere we were going and our contact numbers and all this, and they fingerprinted me. as though, like, I have no criminal record, you know. Like, you know, don't I have some legal rights? But, I mean, it's like, well, you don't want to be fingered, you don't fingerprinted, you don't come into the States, you know. So, so anyway, it's fingerprinted. Yeah. They took my fingerprints there. And then I go out, and we realize that the place they had us park the van was over these big vents. There were big vents underneath the parking spaces. And I felt like, wow, I didn't know that they hadn't put something on or in the van. As like, you know, it'd be very easy to put a little sensing device or whatever. It was very troublesome, but you know, we got over it and kind of went down there and came back and had no suspicions of anything. And while we were down there, we actually drove around Ground Zero, but it was all fenced off, so we couldn't really see anything. And we headed back. And then when I arrived back, my son Dan was coming over for an overnight. And he brought the movie Loose Change with him, which apparently it was near the end of the school year, and the teacher had nothing to do one day, and one of the boys in my son's class had the movie Loose Change, and they put it on and played it, and apparently the teacher was horrified and had no idea what to say. And Dan asked me, have you ever seen this? And I was completely naive up until that point, and then I watched that movie, Loose Change. And in retrospect now, it's not a good movie on 9/11 because it's so misleading in so many regards. But when I watched that movie, and they showed the collapse of the two towers, and they showed as it collapsed the squibs squirting out the side of the building below the fall of the tower. Do you know what I mean by the squibs?
Well, the squibs are actually the things that they put in when they explode. That it's actually, you're seeing an expulsion from the squibs.
That's right. That's what I'm calling the squibs. These explosive outbursts below the level of the top. Yeah.
Pop.
And like, when I saw that, and I saw how these two towers came down in under 15 seconds, close to free fall speed. It's like, it was so obvious to me, like, immediately, like, obviously, we've been lied to. You know, at the time, I had no idea, like, what it meant or who it was or whatever. But seeing that presented so dramatically, and they actually, in the movie Loose Change, as the tower is collapsing and the squibs are coming out and they're circling them and they're playing classical music as it happens, eh? So it was very kind of powerful and shocking to me. And I realized immediately upon seeing that, you know, we've been lied to, that those airplanes can't cause a building to collapse in that way. Like, that's simply impossible. It defies all the laws of physics for that to occur in that manner. So for me and Karen, it was a profoundly shocking movie that really changed our life together. And, you know, after that, like, we began, I'd never been into, like, I'd been on the internet a lot, more exploring mystical and psychical things, but never looking at political movies and that. So that opened up the route for us to start watching, you know, all Alex Jones movies, which are shocking, like Endgame particularly. And then it kind of led to, well, over the last 5 years, this was in 2007. 2006, sorry. It's been 5 years ago that we had that dramatic period of waking up that so changed our life. And then we started spending all our time on the internet watching all these other movies and learning, oh, my goodness, it's not just 9/11. you know, learned then about London train bombings, again, all these irregularities and another false flag event and the Oklahoma City bombing and all these things that had been done through history that we've been deceived about. So it was like one thing led to another. And at the time, my son is in the Canadian military, and he was scheduled to go to Afghanistan. So I felt outraged. Like, I grew up, my father was a career military officer, so I always had respect for the military. And here it was that, you know, we're involved in Afghanistan based on the lies of 9/11, and I just felt furious, like, outraged, morally outraged by the whole 9/11 thing. And at the time, I remember calling my MP, Pierre Poilievre, who belongs to the Conservative Party, and I called up his office. I want, because initially I thought, oh, people in the government, they must not realize this, because I'd been completely asleep. They could have been asleep just like I was. You know, I didn't know. And I called them up, and, you know, they screen your call. So I was talking to a screener, and I started explaining, like, what I'd learned of 9/11 and how it was obviously a fraud. And he tried to counter some of my arguments, but I knew enough that it kind of brushed aside his comments to defend the official story. And then it got to a point, I could tell he knew. He knew it was a lie. And then it turned out he wouldn't let me meet with Pierre Poilievre. I couldn't meet with him. He wouldn't let me meet with him. And I said, well, I've got a son scheduled to go to Afghanistan, and I can't talk to my MP. No, he doesn't want to talk to you. And I realized, oh, the government knows. I realized then, you know, the government knows. At least the Conservatives knew. And that year, I wrote up an article explaining some of 9/11, and on that, on September 11th, 2006, my girlfriend Karen and I, we were the only ones on Parliament Hill in Ottawa, and we went there to protest 9/11, and I was giving out my article, and we had little signs that said 9/11 inside job and things like that. And we went up there, and we expected there to be tens of thousands of people up there. And we got there, and we were the only ones. It was so funny. Not funny, but it just showed us something, how naive we'd been or something. And we spent the afternoon up there and came to the attention of the RCMP. I'm sure they got a copy of my fine paper. And I delivered copies of my paper to the NDP foreign affairs critic on Parliament Hill. But anyway, so we were up on Parliament Hill, and we sat up beside the Chinese lady protesting the organ harvesting of the Falun Gong sect in China, and we spent the day up there. And so the whole period, it set off something in both of us, Karen and myself, during that period of time. And we went through so much. It was like, you know how Gurdjieff says, if a man, an ordinary person kind of awoken to higher consciousness, like they couldn't handle it, it would overwhelm them, it would drive them crazy. Something to that effect, Jim, if they weren't prepared for that. That's kind of like the effect it had on us. I mean, through that period, I thought I experienced these kind of elevated states of consciousness. And we had such unusual things happen to us over a period of time, which maybe someday I'll write about. I don't want to talk about some of the things too much now, because it would make me sound too crazy. And that's the point at which I, one evening, wrote that section, which at the time, I put it up on my website, and I thought at the time that they were revelations. I felt this was something revealed through me. Not that, and I put up on my website, I put these revelations up on my website. And I'm just going to read just the beginning of these. I don't want to go into this too much. Have them here. So, some of the, okay, in my new book that these are going to be in, and these are up on my website. If anyone goes to my website, look at August, I have a, on the front page, I have a little section that says Christopher's Revelations, August 6, 2006. And what I put up there is what I wrote on this day in August of that year. And we posted it up on the our website, but it was creating so much anxiety for us and for Karen especially that we took I took it down after a couple of weeks. We couldn't kind of stay in it. And we went from having periods of illumination and rapture to dread and fearfulness, and so anyway, in my new book, I call it The Revelations, Days of Madness and Illumination. And this is a little bit the beginning part of what I wrote. And it was at the top of my website, which said 0 point. And I said, formerly Institute for Mystical Spiritual Science, and now a website for the words, revelations and judgments of God. That's how you can see the kind of exalted state I felt I was in, eh, Jim? And just to read, revealed to those upright of heart who still speak truth, who still feel love, who care for the holy life within, who want to save your souls, who might learn of the magic of life, becoming the hidden stars you are, as sparks of holiness within the heart spaces of a divine mother, wherein God's mysteries are revealed within. A warning to humanity in your time of need, the wrath of God upon yourselves, and the scum sense their own demise for all their wickedness, sins, greed, deceits, and torture, and cruelties unspeakable. They will turn to staging mass events and cons, even mass murder, creating imaginary enemies without, deceiving you to the enemy within. No real Muslim ever turned mass murder into a feature movie presentation of lies. No real Jew did that. I know better. I love Jews. Real Jews, real Muslims, real Christians, real people. And it kind of goes on in that vein. I read this previously on my show, and I didn't want to read it all again. It's available up on my website. At the time, I felt they were revelations, and I had very profound mystical teachings at that point. I remember thinking that I had, in Kabbalistic terms, climbed the ladder of Jacob, and I felt I had glimpses into the divine world. Like in Kabbalah, there's four worlds of divine, the spiritual, the psychical, and the physical world. And I thought I had these higher kind of experiences. And it actually took us kind of years to come down from that. And both Karen and I, we did a number of things, like trying to do something as truth activists, like to try to wake people up. And then, you know, you wake up to 9/11, and then you realize, oh, how we're being chemtrail sprayed, and all these terrible things that are being done, not only in our own country, but around the world. It was a shocking period of time for us, and it really, I thought, took us years to kind of come down and go about life more normally. Which I think we had both done by the time Karen died, which was almost 4 months ago now. And I just want the main point, I realized the main point of my revelations that day was that I felt that they had done themselves in, that the 9/11, they had shot themselves in the foot, and it was so outrageous that would be the beginning of their own demise. And it's funny, from that time I've always felt that this, their undoing would all come by the year 2012, which to me at this time in my life seems totally unrealistic. But that was what I felt was revealed to me, that this was all going to come undone. So that was a shocking experience, and it's like I felt everything I thought I knew about our country, about the media, about our government, about everything was destroyed. It was like everything was built on lies. And it was like the breakdown of false ego, eh, Jim, that Gurdjieff would talk about. Everything you thought you believed in. Like, I thought we lived in a democratic society, and I believed the government basically served the people, and, you know, delusions like that I had held, you know? And now I see it completely differently. You know, the government knows 9/11 wasn't Muslims, and they've allowed the public to be intentionally deceived through the media. You know, they've allowed this, and the police don't capture the criminals anymore. You know, in the 10 years since 9/11, the only terrorists the RCMP have caught in Canada was terrorists who they set up by having a stooge. They paid this guy with a criminal record over $1 million to kind of get a few young Muslim guys to kind of plan some ridiculous scheme. And then it was exposed, and it was on the front page of every paper in Canada to scare Canadians to reinforce the Muslim threat. You know, it's like so ridiculous. It's like the RCMP don't serve the Canadian people anymore. And it's useless. You can't go to the RCMP. Like, when I've been on Parliament Hill a number of years since I woke up, and it's like, why are these people out here having to demand justice when the RCMP are completely not enforcing the Canadian anti-terrorist legislation? It's like, why are we? Where are the police? The police should be doing this. Ordinary people shouldn't. But you can't even go to the police. You can't even go to the police. They know the truth of this, at least at higher levels. I don't think lower-level officers do. And the same in the military. You know, my son's in the military. He says, Dad, like, he was at one event where they had someone come. An officer kind of was talking about 9/11, and there was one young officer there who still thought Osama bin Laden did it. And it was like all the soldiers were laughing at the guy, like, oh, he still believes in Osama bin Laden. It was like a big joke. It's terrible. They don't realize the implications of this and what lays behind it. You know, the Canadian people, like, they say, oh, support your troops. And it infuriates me when I hear people say, support our troops in the fight in Afghanistan, you know, protecting the world from terrorism, Muslim terrorism, and knowing the whole thing is based on lies, had nothing to do with Muslim terrorism. Instead, it has to do with these New World Order people who are bringing in their new fascist society state. So, you know, it was a crazy time for us, and I've heard other people go through similar kind of traumatic-type experiences, waking up to the truth. And not that you wake up to the truth and know the whole truth. Like, I still don't know the whole truth of 9/11. I don't pretend I do. You know, it gets easier, and you think you understand things, and then there's a whole other level of complexity to everything that emerges. But what we do know is that we've been deceived, and, you know, in Canada, there are people who put all this effort into signing a petition, which is read in the House of Commons, to have, you know, a new inquiry into 9/11, and the government just didn't do anything. They never responded to it. It makes no difference, because the government can't tell on their masters. It's like if you're run by the mob, you can't kind of tell on your mob boss. So government will never. It's like some people, some 9/11 people out at the 9/11, Ottawa 9/11, movement, they think, oh, you know, we got to tell our politicians and inform our politicians. But it's all a joke. The politicians know. You know, these people from Toronto, the global research people, they sent information and their publications to all the MPs of the Canadian Parliament. You know, these people know, and it's this big charade. It's really quite shocking, and it, you know, it changed completely my understanding of view of our society and history and anyway, so over the past years, I've, you know, I don't watch corporate media anymore because I in my view, they're completely owned and controlled by these elites. So they are pathological liars continuously. And one would never know it unless you listen to the truth networks, and then you turn on your TV, and then it's like a joke after a while. It's just, you can see right through these people, and they actually make me physically sick a bit. They sicken me by just realizing what kind of pathological liars and soulless creatures they are. Anyway, so I did, a few years ago, I watched this series of videos done on 9/11 events, and the series is called September Clues. And what September Clues is done by I think he's an American, Simon Schack, and he has a website at septemberclues.com. And if anyone has not watched this video series, I would highly recommend it. And what this series is based on is a media analysis of an analysis of the media coverage of 9/11 events. And I began watching this series, which is very complicated, and it's not narrated by like someone explaining what you're seeing. They use script more, and it's very complicated. I've had to watch it dozens of times. Each time I see new things in it that I hadn't seen before. And that's what led to me writing this article called Fabled Airplanes: The Role of the Corporate Media in Creating and Perpetuating the Mass Hypnosis of the American Public. And when I had written this article, I sent it to filmmaker Simon Schack, and I received this response from him. He said, "I found your article and forensic analysis of September Clues most articulate and acute. By and large, it certainly meets with my full approval as to the overall interpretation of the many human behavioral aspects I strive to highlight in my research documentary. I am obviously well pleased of your comprehensive analysis of my documentary, as it is just the sort of peer review I was hoping would emerge in support of my long-standing research." And then he goes on and he mentions, he says, "However, it would appear you have stopped short of looking into the full and updated research findings as published on my website, septemberclues.info. In the last year, 2 years or so, with the help of several research colleagues, we have determined beyond reasonable doubt that the alleged 3,000 victims of the day were, by and large, fictitious identities generated by a digital database." And then, see, I've not researched this, but Simon Schack has, since doing the September Clues series, he's now claiming that really most of the people we thought were victims of that day, they were really not victims. That's not to say there were no victims, but he's saying that many, you know, after the 9/11 attacks, Jim, in downtown New York, they had that wall where people were supposed to put all the pictures of their loved ones, asking if anyone had seen them. they got copies of those pictures, and they researched to find out who these victims were. And more they found that they don't believe these were real victims. And I don't really want to comment on that because I haven't had time to research what they say. It is shocking what they show on their website about an analysis of some of the photos.
Those buildings did fall down, and there were people in them, so I think that's probably bullshit. I mean, that seems ridiculous to me. Sorry, just 3,000 people died. I think I'm not sure how you can call into question that.
Well, you'd have to look at the evidence to be able to call it into question. I mean, I hadn't until
I'm sure there's somebody. I hope there isn't anybody out there whose loved ones died in the. That just seems completely ridiculous to me. It's like, it seems so far out that, the burden of proof, let's put it, is pretty friggin' high. And it just seems kind of crazy to me. Like, that's my immediate reaction to it. It's just like, come on. There are many aspects of this that don't add up, but the fact is that when two buildings that size fall down, people die. And, that wasn't a figment of people's imagination when people were jumping out of the building,
Well, actually, that also, he does an analysis of that, and some of his photo analysis of that suggests that some of that could have been created fictitiously, too. But I don't really want to go into that because I haven't researched that myself. What I've researched is his article on September Clues. And from my analysis of that article, that's the basis of what I wrote about the fabled airplanes. I mentioned the other as his ongoing research. And when I began to look at his site, I was kind of shocked and taken back a bit by some of the evidences he presents, but I don't feel I've researched it well enough to comment on. But coming back to the September Clues series, after studying it for a long time, I became what's now called in the movement, the truth movement, a no-planer. Okay, and the no-planers are people who think that on 9/11 there were no hijacked airplanes, and the case for establishing that there weren't airplanes at the Pentagon and at Shanksville is more easily apparent. Like, it's obvious a huge Boeing didn't fit into the hole created in the wall of the Pentagon. That's fairly well established.
I agree with that. I don't think.
Yeah, and it's obvious that a full airplane didn't crash in the countryside out of Shanksville, where they gathered it up in a few small pails. Like, I think those are well established facts. But still, the vast majority of people believe that there were indeed airplanes crashing into the two towers. Okay. So, and I believe that, like, from when I woke up in 2006, it was only last year that I finally kind of came to the conclusion that I now believe there were no airplanes on 9/11. And the reason for this, it's complicated, and people would need to read my article. There is definite evidence both of video trickery and video faked videos in the portrayals of the airplane. But the best example, I think, of the evidence of video fakery in the pictures of the airplane was presented. This was from the Fox News helicopter. And the opening scene, they open with a view of the towers from miles north, where it shows for miles over the Hudson River to the right of the screen. And you can see no airplane in sight anywhere in the sky, and you can see one of the two towers is on fire, or the smoke billowing from it. And then, so you begin from a panoramic view of New York, and you don't see any additional airplanes coming in. And then they zoom in once on the towers, then they zoom in again twice, and then they zoom in a third time over a time period of 6 to 7 seconds. And then all of a sudden, there's the airplane in the scene, and the airplane is on their screen for approximately 2 seconds, coming into the screen from the right towards the towers. And what you see is you see the airplane kind of go seemingly into the tower, but then all of a sudden you see the nose of the airplane stick out the other side of the tower. And this is called the nose-out shot. And if anyone wants, if you go to my website, if you go to my homepage and you go down to the article on the right called Fabled Airplanes, the nose-out picture is shown on the website. And what Simon Schack then did, he shows that the picture, the image of the nose of the airplane entering the tower is exactly the same pixel composition as the picture of the nose exiting the other side of the tower, seemingly as though it went right through the tower. This is called the nose-out shot. Now, when you watch this clip, what you see, this airplane, the clip suggests the airplane passes through the whole building, and its nose out is exactly the same pixel as the nose in to the building, as though the airplane were basically aluminum-based, passed through the whole concrete steel building and kept its nose intact the whole time. Also, when you watch this video, and this is what was shown on TV, this isn't some concocted, there were only 5 live shots of the airplane when it occurred, and all of these are in the September Clues series. Now, what you see also in the plane, there's no loss of momentum or speed as it transverses across the screen to stick its nose out on the other side of the building. Now, what this suggests is that indeed that's not a real airplane. What it was a graphic image of an airplane being moved along the horizontal plane, but whoever was looking after it moved it too far so that its nose stuck out on the other side of the tower, which it shouldn't have done. Now, this same clip of the nose-out shot was shown again on CNN within 10 minutes. But when CNN showed the clip on their news, they put their banner, the CNN banner, over the scene so it completely obscured the airplane hitting or coming out of the building. And at the same time, they're completely obscuring this nose-out shot. The announcers are saying, oh, there you see it. There you see the airplane hitting the building. But while the whole time they're saying it, you're not even seeing the airplane because they've completely obscured the scene by their banner, which to me shows that they knew they'd made a mistake, and so they covered it up. There is no way to explain this nose-out shot that I can think of, except that it involved video fakery. And if you look at the pictures of the airplane hitting the building, the airplanes, different ones of them hitting the building, the more closely you look at them, I haven't seen any that obviously aren't fakes. Okay, they're obviously fakes. They had the live coverage, and then subsequently they had a number of people on the street who were supposed to have videotaped it, and they had better images of the second plane hitting the second tower. But in some of these dramatic pictures of the planes hitting the second tower, one thing you see is that just at the moment of impact, the plane's wings seem to disappear. And the wing is not gone, and yet there's still not a hole in the tower. Now, I can't explain all of these details. One simply has to see the video evidence, and I strongly urge people to look at the September Clues series. To me, it's undeniable evidence that these images of the planes hitting the tower were faked within the media studios, and these people who subsequently from the street handed in their videos of this second plane, you can see that they're frauds. Okay. Because from the very beginning of seeing 9/11, I remember watching the scenes and looking at the scenes of the burning building, and you look inside, where's that airplane? Where's this airplane? Like, does a person really think an airplane made mainly of aluminum is going to simply pierce the side of this building and go in as a whole without breaking up on impact with the walls of the towers? It's not conceivable. Some, perhaps the engine or the nose, might pierce the building, but the wings would definitely break up. They wouldn't. But see, what you see in the images of these planes, the planes go right into the tower and disappear completely from view. And there's a gaping hole there in the side of the tower, and you look in the hole, and you don't see any evidence of an airplane. See, there's so many inconsistencies in this material. Another thing is, if you compare different images of the plane, you realize that in some of the images, the plane is like a black blob, or it's dark in color. In other, it's white. In one, it descends from above. It descends down, and it penetrates the tower at this very sharp angle, downward angle. Whereas in another video of the same airplane, it's on a completely horizontal course moving across your screen. The airplane is not like a quantum particle. Like they say, a quantum particle in a way can be here, there, and everywhere at the same time until you collapse its wave function, and then all of a sudden the particle has discrete properties. Well, an airplane isn't like that. All the different images of the airplane hitting the tower are inconsistent with each other in the color, in the shape, in the trajectory. And the easiest way to make sense of it all is they're all faked. And a number of the people who turned in these amateur videos, like the most famous one, this fellow Herkazatz or some name like that, when he was asked about his video, he says, "Talk to my lawyer." And another one of the people who handed in the videos from the street, two of the others were specialists in graphic animation. You see, what I believe these people did, they were likely on the street and took pictures of the towers when the explosions occurred, and then they went back to their media studios and concocted these images of the plane penetrating the tower to coincide with the towers being blown out as they were. So I now am in this camp called the no-planers. Okay. That's part of the story. And but my analysis of the September Clues series, one of the points of my analysis is that there were no planes and that these were faked in the media studios. But the other point of my analysis, I discovered, was in examining the eyewitness testimony reported live on TV on that day. And what I discovered by doing an analysis of some of this eyewitness testimony is that I believe it also is completely phony. These witnesses were scripted. And if you looked carefully at what they said, you see obvious inconsistencies and obvious deception. And I want to play on air here what I consider the most obvious example of a scripted witness. And this account, I'm only going to play about 20 seconds of it. It's in part one of the September Clues series. And this is what was shown on CBS. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this, and then I transcribed it. See, when I was getting my PhD, I developed a way of analyzing psychotherapy tapes. And when I did my PhD work, I realized how hard it is to transcribe psychotherapy tapes because there's so many little things that go by that you don't notice until you have to kind of record it. And then you find all these subtle things which otherwise you wouldn't even notice. So I'm going to play this script. I'm going to play this clip. And it is of a witness, Teresa Renault. And you'll find on the 9/11 day, all of the witnesses were media insiders. All of them, almost all of them, were media insiders. And this is Teresa Renault. And I'm going to play this clip, and then I'm going to talk about it, and then we'll re-listen to it again after I've explained some of, because it's very hard to understand. I hope this comes across. But I'm going to put my phone up to my computer and play this. This is Teresa Renault.
I remember all the stories my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high in the sky. There wasn't any shame, there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life, Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. And then the white man came, he brought his way of life. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought their gun. They took away our land, they put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation, changed our ways of life. Promises were made, they were only lies. And then the white man came, he brought his way alive. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Some days what he said, the nations they will rise. All the chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride. Armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride. The day the white man came, he brought
Yeah, hi. I'm afraid there's a little bit of a mix-up there, and we went to break, and I tried playing this clip. I'm not sure it's going to be heard loudly enough on my computer. People can go to part one of the September Clues series, and it's at 1 minute and 48 seconds into part one of the series. But this is the transcript that I transcribed from what was said with this witness. And see, this witness was on air at the moment of the second impact of the supposed airplane. And the host is saying, "This is Bryant Gummel. I'm down at 50." Sorry,
Bryant Gummel.
Gummel. Yeah, thank you. I'm down at 59th and 5th. Where are you? And Mrs. Teresa Renault says, "I am in Chelsea, which is quite far north of the towers, at least half a mile to a mile." She says, "I'm in Chelsea, and we are at 8th and 16th. We are the tallest building." Now, here she's saying "we," but I assume, like, she's talking about she and her husband. Like, you know, we live at 18th, 8th and 16th. We are the tallest building in the area. And we, then she says, "My window faces south." So all of a sudden it went from "we" to "my window faces south." So it looks directly onto the World Trade Center. And I would say, you know, approximately 10 minutes ago, there was a major explosion from probably, it looks like, about the 80th floor. It looks like it has affected probably 4 to 8 floors. Major flames are coming out of the, let's see, the north side and also the east side of the building. Yes. And then the host says, "Yes, you're over in Chelsea. Did you hear the explosion from your position?" And Mrs. Renault says, "Oh, yes, yes, we did. As a matter of fact, we heard it, and 'cause I was just, like, standing there, pretty much looking out the window. I didn't see what caused it or if there was an impact." Okay, so she just says, "I didn't see what caused it or if there was an impact." And the host then starts to say, "So you have no idea right now," and then his sentence is interrupted then because you see an airplane enter the picture and hit the tower. So, but it sounds like the host is saying, "So you have no idea right now, like, what happened." Because she just said that she didn't see what caused it, she said, or if there was an impact. So the host says, "So you have no idea right now?" And then Mrs. Renault says, "Oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Oh, my God, another plane has just hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Explosion."
How to become another.
Yes.
Yeah, if you didn't see
She just said
plane.
That she didn't know what caused...
If you didn't see a first plane, how can there be another one?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that sounds pretty scripted to me.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. That's really good.
Yeah, and this is criminal evidence, eh? Because this is documented coverage from that day. She one moment says, "I didn't see what caused it." And then you see a plane, and you see the second impact, and then she says, "Oh, another airplane just hit."
I would call that very unreliable testimony.
And it was also interesting because...
Very interesting. So she's some sort of a plant, or it certainly sounds like it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I want to just go into other elements of it a little bit because...
That's quite shocking. I mean, that you know, that's very interesting.
She said the way... See, another thing I was attentive to is how she used "we" and "I" in her script.
People do that when they talk.
No,
I mean, you know...
No, well, not, no, I haven't said what I... Like, okay. Listen to this. Because she says... She starts out and she says, "We are at 18th and 16th. We are the tallest building in the area." Well, that's fine. That's not a problem. Like, people do talk like that. You know, we live at wherever, okay? and we, she says, but then she switches my window faces south. Now, you'll see what I'm getting at is I think her husband's there, but he's telling her that she saw it. It's not we. He wants her just to be saying I. And then she says, at one point she says, as a matter of fact, we, she repeats it, we heard it, and 'cause I was just like standing there, pretty much looking out the window. Now, isn't that interesting script? Have you ever pretty much looked out the window, Jim?
Yes.
Okay.
Every day. I mean, I don't find that particularly unusual. People do that all day, especially if you live in New York or a big city where there's a skyline. I don't find that anything terrible. I find another incredibly suspicious. That's completely inconsistent with what she said.
Yes.
I don't see anything. And then another one had, wait a minute, where did the first one come from? You just said you didn't know. And the word impact, too. What would you make? That seems weird to me.
She says she didn't
impact.
Know if there was an impact,
yeah,
which makes
it like that something hit it.
Yeah, yeah, and that she really did know it was supposed to be a plane.
Yeah, I mean, given that the building had already been blown up before, it would have been reasonable to assume that it was another bomb.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, because of the previous bombs in the World Trade Center. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so this is the most damning of all the evidences. But as I listen through September clues, I transcribe a series of these scripted witnesses. And my conviction is that they were all scripted. That I'll read one other example.
Well, they didn't do a very good job, though, if they were scripted.
They did a terrible job. But the problem was, if someone is scripted and they don't really see what they're supposedly recounting, then their language isn't really appropriate because it's based on being scripted rather than the perception of true events.
Yeah, but if they're scripted, they should just follow. There should be a script that if you want somebody to tell the story, then you write a script and you tell them stick to the script.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Well, it's like, if you're going to go to all that trouble, why wouldn't you just have somebody rehearse it and then say it? It's very peculiar, but I'm not sure that it follows what you're saying about. It's very peculiar what she said. Like, that is very odd.
Yeah.
Like
it makes no sense.
Basically, that's what I'm saying.
Another thing that's very peculiar is that at the end, she says, oh my God, another plane has just hit another building, flew right into the middle of it. Explosion.
Hmm.
Now, I've never heard anyone just say explosion. Now, to me, when I hear that, because the explosion's already occurred a couple seconds earlier, but she puts at the end of her explanation, she says, explosion. Now, without a sense, just explosion. Okay? Now, what I think it is she had some paper and it had in front of her and it said explosion on it, and she added it on at the end because she had forgotten to say it.
Yeah.
So she gets to the end and says, oh, explosion. I encourage my listeners, go to September Clues and listen to this segment of Teresa Renault. And when I listen to this segment, it's not only of her. I would like to just have another example of this. If anyone's interested, I'm doing a two-hour show on Tuesday morning with Charles Giuliani on the Truth Hurts radio show, where I'm gonna have to deal with this so I can play these clips properly. But I'm gonna go into more detail and hopefully be a bit more organized on that day. But here's another what I think is the most phony evidences. Evidence of the fact that these witnesses were scripted. The media, in my view, knew ahead of time. Now, there's all kinds of evidence in this for this in the September Clues series. You've just got to watch a series. One of the most peculiar things is how often at the moment of impact on these live broadcasts, the live broadcasts fade to black at the moment of the impact. At the exact moment the plane comes in and hits the building, the screen fades out. They fade to black. And then a moment later, they fade back in. And you see this fading to black at the moment of impact on two of the five live shots of this occurring. Another thing you find is you find they have these timing devices, which are offset by 17 seconds from the explosion. All of this is in the September Clues series, all of which suggests this whole thing was scripted. But here is one other example. I'm trying to find... two examples. Here's another one. This is Fox News. A few minutes after the first strike, had one of its online producers of Fox Report, Owen Mugen, on scene. And Owen says, "I am on the roof of my building, which is about five blocks to the south of the World Trade Center, and I'm looking right now at the World Trade Center. There's a massive gaping hole on the second tower. It's unbelievable to look at. There's a massive hole." And then the host says, "It looks something like out of a movie. There's a huge hole in the side of tower number one." See, the host corrects Owen as to what tower had been hit. Now, Owen is supposed to be on the roof of his building, but he thinks he's describing the airplane hitting the south tower. Okay, he says that there's a massive gaping hole on the second tower. Now, I would take the south tower to be the second because its construction was completed second. Secondly, and it's the second tower built. But so he confuses which tower where the massive hole is. And then the host, he says, "Oh yeah, it's like something out of a movie. There's a huge hole in the side of tower number one," he says. So he's correcting Owen. And then you hear Owen, under his breath, say to himself, "Tower one." Like he's repeating, as if repeating himself so as to remember. He's supposed to be on the roof observing this, and he mixes up which building's been hit. A third example. This is a good one. This witness is Eric Shawn, a Fox TV terror expert and war correspondent. And this interview with Eric Shawn is 41 seconds after the second airplane is supposed to have hit. And Eric Shawn, he says, "I was walking down Fifth Avenue, which is close to our studios, and I heard a jet, perhaps a 737 or a small Airbus, flying low, unusually low over Fifth Avenue, making a right." Now, if anyone's seen an airplane, like, do airplanes make rights? And he's describing it as though it was a car. It was coming down Fifth Avenue and it made a right. Okay? Now, if you've seen the pictures of the second airplane coming in over the Hudson River, and it flies directly into the tower. I never see it making a right. Then Eric Shawn says, "I'm not going to say, I don't know. I don't have any reports on what kind of plane just hit the World Trade Center. But people looked up, and it made a right towards the building. What we just saw, though, was obviously, if that would be, was a second aircraft that hit the south tower of the World Trade Center, that obviously raises the specter of an intentional terrorist attack here, if that is indeed what we are looking at. I don't know what the reports are, what the reports say, what type of plane hit the tower, but I did see a jet airliner that was fairly low." Now, What I'm trying to get at here is I don't believe Eric Shawn saw an airplane. He was brought on immediately after the second attack because the point the host was trying to make, well, if that's a second airplane hitting a second building, then there must be something to this. This must be a terrorist event. And they had Eric Shawn on the scene, who was a terror expert and war correspondent. And while they were interviewing Eric Shawn, and he's trying to describe the airplane here, they list on screen Eric's areas of expertise, including the 93 World Trade Center bombings, the Waco attack, the TWA Flight 800, the anthrax attacks, or the anthrax threat, and lastly, but most importantly, the hunt for bin Laden. Okay, so 40 seconds after the second airplane hit the tower, they happened to have this terror expert on TV, Eric Shawn, and it lists as one of his areas of expertise, the hunt for bin Laden. Okay, and this is another one, the way Eric Shawn, his language in this script, I don't know how much it comes across. I've never heard of anyone describing an airplane as making a right. Okay, they don't make right turns or left turns. They might veer right, but he doesn't say that. He talks as though it makes a right. And he kind of describes the airplane, but he doesn't, he says people looked up. And he describes people looking up at the airplane, but it's not till the last sentence that he said, but I did see a jet airliner that was fairly low. Okay, even though he begins by saying he heard a jet, perhaps a 737 or a small Airbus flying low, unusually low. It's not till the end that he says he saw it. He says he heard it. He saw other people looking up, but it wasn't till the end of his testimony that he built up the courage to actually say he saw it. And now he knew it was a jet airplane, even though earlier in his language, he said it could have been a 737 or a small Airbus. Eric Shawn was another scripted witness, in my view. And the more you look at the witnesses they had on scene that day, my belief is they were scripted witnesses. Because in my view, the media coordinated the five major networks. Everybody else was knocked off the air, fortunately for them, or coincidentally. Everybody else is knocked off the air. And I believe these people actually scripted the day's events. And these witnesses were planned ahead of time. They knew what the story was going to be. I've just touched upon some of the evidences in the September Clues series about this. There's much more. My article is up on my website. It's almost 50 pages long. I break it down and go into a lot more detail. So that, in my view now, I'm a no-planer, but the point of my article isn't simply that there were no planes, but I'm also saying that the media took part in staging this event, actually staging it. These people knew what was happening. And there's just so many inconsistencies and inexplicable facts in their testimony as to what they observed. So, yeah. So that's kind of my main point in the September Clues. And I bring that up today because I did want to talk about one other aspect here, which is in the 9/11 movement now, in different shows I've listened to in this last week. There's a number of people kind of claiming that, like, the 9/11 movement has been infiltrated. And a lot of people think that if someone is a no-planer, that that's one of these people, like, trying to create discord in the 9/11 movement. And that's ridiculous because the main people believe there were airplanes. Now, I'm trying to make a couple points here, and there's dissension within the 9/11 movement, and a lot of this has to do with the work of Dr. Judy Wood. Are you familiar with her work, Jim, at all? Okay, she was on Coast to Coast, and she's been on all the truth networks. And she's a material scientist who's written a massive new book on 9/11, littered with photographs. Because there were so many anomalies on the street. Like, have you ever seen pictures of all the burnt cars?
No, not offhand.
There are all these kind of anomalies where kind of cars are like half melted away, but the other half of them isn't even damaged at all. And cars turned over and flipped over and all these very peculiar things. And her book is called Where Did the Towers Go? Because she says when these massive towers collapsed, it's like she believes that they used some other kind of weaponry, some type of directed energy weapon that, in a sense, dematerialized the buildings. That this substance was actually turned to fine dust, not just as happens in the controlled demolition, but much more than that. And she says a pile of rubble after the collapse of a 120-story building is only a few floors high. Like, where did the towers go? Where did all the material? Now, I don't know what to make of her work, but there are many, many enigmatic photos about 9/11 which aren't explained, even if you accept, as I generally have, I've accepted the architects and engineers' evidence that thermite was used in the controlled demolition, and that was how I always thought of what happened on 9/11. Judy Wood, her work suggests there's something much more peculiar. She can't really explain it. She's just trying to get people to look at the evidences for it. But what's creating dissension is Judy Wood was not invited to this Toronto symposium. And there's certain people in the architects and engineers, they dismiss her work without really showing an interest in it or answering comments she makes, which is all very peculiar. The some of it all is that some people think now that Stephen Jones and Richard Gage are kind of gatekeepers, that these are people who play a certain role in leading the 9/11 truth movement, but in ways these people are also bought out and are not really looking at the whole issue scientifically and keeping an open mind. So this is a little bit, I'm trying to give a flavor that this is what's happening in the 9/11 movement. That's why a lot of people think the Toronto conference, they've excluded Judy Woods. And I remember meeting Richard Gage, and I was asking him, you know, I about whether he thought there had to be airplanes, because to me, there's no possible way an airplane, an aluminum-based airplane, is going to penetrate a tower without breaking up to some extent on impact, but instead it goes right into the building, just hunky-dory, right into the building, disappearing completely from view. You see no evidence of an airplane when you see the gaping holes in the towers. Where'd the airplanes go? You see, to me, the architects and engineers, they should be attempting to model the impact of a jetliner against a building like that. That's what I think the evidences would call upon them to do. You know, you see the model, the impact of the airplane on the towers. Well, why don't we model the impact of the airplane on a building like this? I do not believe the airplanes would just disappear inside that.
But at the end of the day, I mean, what Richard Gage is suggesting is that these buildings were blown up. So, I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he's challenging the official story. He's challenging it from another angle. And I mean, it's like, you know, to say that he's a gatekeeper or whatever is like, you know, well, there's no evidence of that. I mean,
he's sticking his neck out, his professional reputation. I mean, and he, you were there. I mean, he convinces engineers and architects. When we went to that talk, there were many, many engineers and architects present, some of whom believed the official story. At the end, not one believed that the official story after his presentation. So
yeah, in Toronto, out of hundreds.
And Stephen Jones, too. I mean, you know, it cost him his career to a certain extent. That's my understanding. I mean, and who's to say that this woman's correct anyway? I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, maybe she is, maybe she isn't. But, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's a very complex question. But I, like, in terms of the buildings, the actual collapse of the buildings, he's saying the official story is bogus, and it's like this is a Gage and Jones are saying, have called attention to the fact that the official story is completely unbelievable in terms of engineering and architecture.
Yeah.
Like it just does not add up. And as they say, well, there must have been, I think there were 27 or 28 engineers and at least 20-some architects at that talk that he gave in Toronto, and every one of them said they didn't believe the official story after his presentation.
Exactly.
So.
Well, Jim, actually, your comments raise what I was trying to come to.
Okay.
Because I agree with what you're saying. And I think, like, we know it was a controlled demolition. Okay. Now, whether it was, I believe it could have been thermite and other weapons.
Well,
because
I think there's overwhelming evidence that there was thermite used in the explosion. I think that's what I think the smoking gun is that in terms of, and that also raises the huge question as to why was all that molten steel and all that steel taken away afterwards? That was a crime scene. It was never properly investigated.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but my point is, I think it's really important, like, in the 9/11 movement, you know, we don't want discord within the movement. And the fact that thermite was found in the explosion doesn't discount what someone like Judy Woods is trying to say. And similarly, like someone like myself, who honestly believes there were no airplanes, it doesn't mean I'm trying to create dissension or diffuse attention or something. It's that I'm an honest investigator, and this is what my research has led me to believe. Okay, now whether or not that's true, in a way, as Jim is saying, it is a side issue. Because the evidence is, no matter whose camp you're in, shows that it was a fraud. These buildings were brought down, and they were pre-wired or exploded in some other mechanism. It wasn't due to an airplane. So we don't want to create discord within the community. Because now what I hear is some people saying, oh, Stephen Jones and Richard Gage are gatekeepers, they're deceiving us. And other people, oh, it's Judy Woods. And it's creating this animosity. And I think we can't allow that to happen. And that this is, we don't understand what happened on 9/11. And we need to keep our minds open and really consider these evidence carefully. And that's even in my view, like I'm a no planer, but I would be very upset to realize that I'd made a mistake and there were airplanes. I put myself on the line in expressing this. I don't say that there were no airplanes and that the media was scripted. I don't say something like that lightly. I'm trying to contribute to an honest forensic kind of examination of the evidences here, and I don't know of other people who are actually suggesting that these witnesses are scripted, other than Simon Schack in his video. But the main point I'm trying to make is that you know, we need to come together in the 9/11 movement and not let these kinds of differences divide us, and to try to be respectful of alternative views and considerations. I think that's kind of along the line of what you were saying, hey, Jim. I mean, the overwhelming evidence is that, you know, we've been deceived about it, and the buildings were somehow demolished through some type of controlled demolition. That's obvious, no matter whose camp you're in.
Exactly the same thing happened in amongst the Kennedy assassination researchers too. You know, like, I mean, there was a division, and there was, you know, talked that certain people were plants, and certainly there are some books out there and some articles that are definitely written by people that are, you know, it's disinformation, but
yeah.
You know, it's inevitable, right? I mean, when you have that kind of questioning, but you say you have to respect people. I mean, I believe there were planes, but listening to you today, I mean, I'll look at things more closely and I'll try to examine. I clearly believe that that woman was scripted. I think, you know, that's a very good point. And that's it. It's even when people are, see, in the Kennedy assassination, even people whose ideas I don't agree with or who put up theories that I think are ridiculous, some of them do some incredibly good work on certain aspects of the case, eh? So
yeah.
That's the thing. It's like, you know, nobody's got a monopoly on the truth. If anybody really knew what was going on, they'd probably be a vice president out selling a book, but that's a whole other story. You know, no, I mean, that's it. We don't know what happened. So, I mean,
no, we don't.
It's very interesting. And I mean, but the bottom line is that people who don't believe 9/11 is that, you know, that the official story is bogus, and that it's the reason to legitimize going to war.
Yeah. Yeah, and many other things.
And many other crimes.
Yeah.
I think we're out of time, eh?
Yeah, we just got a couple minutes, so we need to close up. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go off quite so long on 9/11, but I felt I did. You know, it's been an issue through the last years. For the last 5 years of our show, we keep returning to it, and because 9/11 is coming up again, I think this is, I'm very pleased with this piece of original contribution I feel I've made to the 9/11 research, and I'd encourage people, watch the September Clues series, and I have a long article on my website. It's all illustrated with all kinds of pictures. And see, when all these things happen, we just kind of led to believe things, and when we really look at the evidences, we find a lot of strange anomalies. So hopefully some year we will gain justice, and the truth about these things will come out. And Jim, I'm going to send you, when I send you a copy of my two new books, I'll send you a copy of September Clues on DVD. Because I sent it out to a number of radio show hosts too, because I thought it was so important that I sent it out to people who had some influence on other people who also became no-planers. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. My website's www.zeropoint.ca. Thank you, BBS Radio. Thanks, James Moffitt.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Okay. Goodbye.
Thanks, Don. Bye.